League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
For 13 years, 22 series and 175 shows, Richard Porter was script editor of Top Gear. From the first pilot episode in 2002 until the very last show presented by Clarkson, Hammond and May in 2015. His new book, And On That Bombshell, tells stories from behind the scenes of one of the world's most successful TV shows. I'm absolutely delighted to welcome Richard to the show. Good morning, Richard.
Morning.
Wow, that's a lot of shows, isn't it? When you look at it like that, 13 years. Years of your life.
I know. You'd get less for various crimes. It's extraordinary. Also, because TV years are like dog years. People in television are very, very flighty and superficial, and they tend to work on a show for, you know, a year or so and then move on because everybody's freelance. So doing 13 years is quite a long stretch. And I used to say to people, I'd meet friends of friends who worked in television, they'd say, oh, what are you doing? And I'd say, oh, I'm still on Top Gear. And they'd go, oh, really?
Get yourself a proper job.
Yeah, it's up for you. And I sort of have to sit on my hands and not go, look, we've got loads of viewers, it's fine.
Oh, funny. Do you remember the first pilot show? Because apparently it was a bit disastrous, wasn't it?
Yeah, I remember it vividly. It's amazing what you can dredge out from the suspected sewer of your mind. And I was there on that that day. We went down for the first time to our studio and we had this very elaborate set built and we'd got all these various gimmicks and things that we were going to do to reveal the Stig and so on. And it was all an unmitigated disaster. Oh. And when we actually cut it all together in an edit suite and played it to BBC management, we all sat there sort of with our mouths hanging open going, oh, God, what have we done?
Really?
And yeah, it was patently obvious that it was absolutely terrible and everybody knew this. And so, bless them, the BBC bosses said, look, go away and have another go. Which is very generous of them.
Yeah.
So we did. We went and we made a second pilot show, and it was even worse. And so at that point, we'd run out of time and money. And under normal circumstances, the BBC would have been well within their rights to say, I'm afraid that's it.
Yeah.
You had two strikes, now you're out. That's no good. This isn't going to work. But bless them, they had faith in us. They had faith in Jeremy particularly, and they said, all right, go on, there's no time left, you'll have to make your first series, and this time, please don't muck it up.
How wonderful. And on that first series, James May wasn't part of the team then, was he?
No, we made a joke on the show a lot about James having no sense of direction and getting lost and being late, and
yeah,
we extended that to claiming that he was even late for the show and forgot to turn up for the first series. I mean, the truth is, we had another chap. We had a guy called Jason Dorr who we'd sort of found through our audition process. He was a former car dealer who used to train other car dealers in how to sell. Very charismatic, very funny guy, but he'd never done TV before. And I think we expected too much of him because he was so good from the off in the basics of television, of just being able to look in the right direction and speak and walk and do sort of these things at the same time. And then management, after the first series, said, oh, we don't think that Jason's working out, as management are prone to do. They also said, for the record, and I've put this in the book, oh, we don't think Richard Hammond's working out. Yeah, we might have a think about that. And somebody from management rang Hammond just before Christmas and went, listen, Rich, we're not sure that we're going to have you on the next series of the show, but we haven't decided yet. We'll let you know in the new year. Listen, have a good Christmas.
Bye. Oh, no.
I know, imagine. It was just, I mean, the cruelest thing. And then, fortunately, they came to their senses and I think they could see what we could see in him, which was this brilliant, enthusiastic, funny guy who loved cars. And he was an asset to the show. And so they kept him on, but they said, we think maybe you should sort of look around for someone else. And we sort of had a feeling that James was possibly the right person. We knew James already because he presented Top Gear in the old days, and he knew Jeremy from when they were car journos together. So we sort of combed the pubs of West London until we found him, and then he turned out to be better than we could ever have hoped.
Are all three of them as fanatical about cars and as passionate about cars as it comes across?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, that's the thing. I think that it's possibly not stated enough that, you know, maybe people thought when they watched the show that perhaps they were winging it or they were reading off a script. But I can absolutely promise you that they love cars possibly more than they would care to admit, no more than they would care to admit. And you know, Jeremy would love to claim that he's not a full car geek. But if you said to him, Jeremy, what would the exact make and size of tyres fitted to the Mark 1 Golf GTI, he would be able to rattle it off without thinking.
Oh.
That kind of level of ingrained geekery, and he can remember the number plates of every car that his dad owned and that he's owned, and all this sort of stuff that marks out true car geeks. James and Richard are the same, absolutely in their blood.
If your car broke down, would they be able to fix it for you?
Right. In order, the people I would ask to fix my car if it broke down, I think probably James.
Yep.
Very closely followed by Richard, because he's pretty handy as well. And then a huge, huge gap in which I might just ask strangers for help. Then Jeremy. Now, that's not to say he doesn't know how a car works. He sort of tries to pretend he doesn't, but he's, you know, he knows the basics. But he's just, as we saw on the show, again, I think people maybe thought some of this was television artifice, and it wasn't. He has no patience with sort of fiddly tasks.
Yes.
And just resorts to sort of belting things with a hammer. And whereas James, of course, is the exact opposite. James is just has an infinite amount of patience for doing something minute and tricky and getting it right and making sure it's absolutely spot on. And you know, cross-threading something would cause James to visibly blanch, and he would have to go back and do it properly, whereas Jeremy would just be sort of there, the screw wouldn't go, and he'd just glue it in place.
That kind of rings true, yeah, I can get that. And your role in this, Richard, as a script editor, what was the kind of process of how a show came together then and your role in it?
Well, I was sort of there, as a fourth brain on the script, because there's some parts of Top Gear that were just sort of very natural and very fluid, but there were some bits we did use to script to varying degrees. So studio links, you know, if a presenter's looking straight down the camera, that's usually a scripted line, because it has to be for various tedious reasons like timing and stuff. Also, if they're doing just a single car test on the track again, I mean, if we've driven the car in advance, we know what we're going to say about it, we'd write a script for that. And really, I was there as a sort of just kind of to help out, because two heads are better than one, and four heads are better than three. So when we were trying to come up with stuff, when we were writing, I'd be there sort of to chip in with suggestions. You know, I mean, all three of them are writers, and Jeremy particularly is a real kind of connoisseur of words, and he likes to craft things on the screen, and he'd just be there. He would often drive the computer, and I'd pace around behind him, and we'd sort of try and come up with these chewy metaphors and things like that. But I'm a terrible, terrible bore when it comes to cars, way more than they are.
Really?
I'm terrible. You don't invite me to parties or anything. So for sort of facts about cars, they would look to me, because I'd probably have read the press release from front to back, and they saved them the bother of having to wade through the bit about windscreen wipers.
Love it. I love it. And the live audience, how important was that as part of making that show work?
I think it was very important, actually, because when I went to see Jeremy and our producer, Andy Willman, back in 2002, and they said, we're bringing Top Gear back, they said, we're going to do it in a studio. And I remember saying, well, a car show in a studio? I don't understand. That's not going to work.
Mm.
Which kind of shows how much I know. But it did seem weird, because cars move, and it seemed strange to willfully sort of pen them in. But the audience was a crucial part of that, because it gave a different atmosphere to it. And it also, it sort of justified and was enmeshed in things like Star in a Reasonably Priced Car.
Because
that feature was very important for a number of reasons. It brought another voice to the show, so you weren't just listening to Jeremy, James and Richard talking for the whole hour. It also was a good excuse to get some, in the end, pretty big names doing this ridiculous lap in a small hatchback, which we quite enjoyed how ridiculous that seemed. but also, There was a sort of pacing thing. It broke it up. We decided we were having the studio. We had to use it. And then having the audience there gave it that very different feel and that atmosphere of sort of almost being, I mean, in the early days, we used to call it the bunker. I mean, it was plainly no such thing. It's an aircraft hangar. But we used to say it was a Top Gear bunker.
Yeah.
The idea being, it was this sort of safe haven. If you liked cars, come down and hang out in our bunker. It was the sort of gist of it. And then, of course, a few years in, we kept being told, oh, there's a 20-year waiting list for tickets and so on, and we were a bit like, oh, how did that happen? Because in the early days, we could barely get a dozen people in there, and some of them would try and leave before the end, and we'd have to beg them to stay. And when they applauded stuff, it sounded like a village cricket match.
Oh, wonderful. Terrible. Wonderful. I guess part of the real genius of Top Gear was, even if you weren't that much of a car fanatic, it was still a really good watch.
Yeah, I think that probably sort of evolved that way. It was, as a lot of things were on the show, it was a bit accidental. We never sat down and said, we're going to make a car show that's accessible so that your, you know, your mum and your mate who doesn't like cars will watch it as
right.
well. What we did, we sat down and we said, we want to make a car show that's just isn't like anything that's gone before and you know, is hopefully entertaining. But really, we were still aiming towards our core audience, which is people, you know, car fans, people who are actually interested in horsepower and crankshafts and things.
Mm.
And I suppose just by accident, when the natural chemistry of Richard, James and Jeremy started to come out, and bearing in mind, it took us four series to put them together on location, you know, they used to be together in the studio, then they would go off and all the pre-shot stuff would be individual, and then we sort of cautiously put them together, and then went, Oh, they're really good together. Oh, we should do this more. And this became kind of then the bedrock of the show. And that was probably the turning point.
Yes.
Because it's the one thing you can't fake. You can't fake that kind of chemistry. They really were mates. After 13 years, they could still bear to be in the same room together, which I think is pretty amazing,
yeah,
really.
Totally agree.
And that you just can't make it up. They sort of had enough in common to get on, but enough that was different that they found each other mildly irritating sometimes, which, of course, makes for funny arguments and debates, and that came across really well as sort of a natural chemistry. And I just think people doing stuff they love is a very watchable thing, whether it's David Attenborough or Adam Hart Davis or someone like that, Peter Snow, someone who just clearly loves their subject and is having fun. And I think our guys looked like they were having fun because they were. So that draws people in. You don't have to really know or care about the subject. You just have to think, I like these people, and I'm going to see what they've got to say.
About the controversial bits of Top Gear, Clarkson seemed to manage to get himself into some quite incredible situations, which did seem to be mainly his fault. I mean, he sparked a diplomatic incident in Mexico. He yeah. made provocative remarks about pretty much everybody and everything. He, of course, then had his N-word thing. And then there's that Falklands issue, which must have been extraordinary to be part of.
Yeah, the Falklands one was particularly fortunate because, for once, it wasn't us, and we weren't
yeah.
hanging around. You know, and I can't say this often and loud enough, that it really was a total coincidence, and that we were as shocked as everyone else when we saw that people started reading things into this number plate that simply weren't there. And we kept trying to explain, look, you know, we'd already planned we were going to Argentina sort of back in the early part of the year, sort of March, April time, I think. And we belatedly bought the cars pretty much just in time to get them on the ship to send them over there to start filming, because it's all locked in. These things are a logistical exercise that like you've never seen.
I'm sure, yeah.
So to get a car with that number plate, we'd have had to hack the DVLA computer, or we'd have had to buy the car and then sort of build the story around it. But
yeah.
we could very easily prove, you know, we'd been planning the story and had sent people out there to have a recce of what was there, sort of back in the spring, early summer. We bought the cars later than that, you know. It was all rather unfortunate. But then the way it escalated, and the fact that, you know, it was probably the closest that our long-serving and very brave and dedicated crew came to fearing for their lives. I mean, we got into a few scrapes over the years. And in fact, last time we were in South America, we were in Bolivia, and we had a local drug lord threaten to kill us.
As you do.
Just a fact of life. Bolivia,
when in Bolivia, do as the Bolivians
exactly,
do.
Yeah, there's a lot of things in Bolivia that appear to be out to kill you, mostly animals and insects.
Yeah.
And yeah, as it turns out, also local drug barons don't take kindly to asking you if they can turn their music down. So, yeah, we had come sort of brushed with death a little bit, but not really come as close as we did in Argentina. And of course, back in the UK, everyone was going, well, this is typical. Just typical of Top Gear. And I could sort of see that point of view, because I sort of felt, well, yeah, we have done some silly things. But I was also thinking, it's a bit subtle for us.
Yeah.
The number plate, I mean, you've got to really concentrate, because it doesn't look like 1982 Falklands to me. It looks like a normal British car number plate.
But exactly.
When you're used to number plates like that, you don't really look twice at them.
Funny.
We'd have painted a slogan down the side of the car or something, because that was kind of our MO in the past.
So. Well, my number plate in Spain here has got it's HRH. And,
really? How dare you?
I'm just waiting to be arrested.
You're just stoking up fury about Gibraltar and things like that.
And that was a complete coincidence, Richard, honestly.
I'm going to write a stiff letter to somebody.
And on a very serious note, just before we finish, Richard Hammond, of course, had an incident which he nearly lost his life, and that must have been a very, very difficult time for the whole Top Gear family.
Yeah, that was one of those ones where, I mean, talking about brushes with death, of course, I mean, that was the closest we really did.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was really shocking because it came at a point when, you know, the show was had sort of dug in and was really successful and, you know, we felt we were doing good work. But more than that, we'd been doing it long enough that we really were this, we used to describe ourselves as a dysfunctional family. You know, we were all mates. So it was a period when we used to go out together a lot and Richard would come along. He used to delight in coming out for one of our nights on the town, and we would sort of use him as like a live-action VIP card and try and go, look, this guy's famous, can we come into your club, please? And he was always sort of mortified by this, but we'd play along. And so we used to have a lot of fun away from the office and away from the studio. And so it really was, when it happened, it was like, oh, God, we haven't just killed a colleague, you know, we've almost killed a mate here. And that's a terrible thing to happen, and thankfully, you know, he came through it, and he's there's one thing about Richard that I always in awe of is that he is one of the sort of pluckiest and bravest blokes I know, because it's not just that he came back and then kept on working on the show, but that there was never a point when we were sort of planning new adventures that he'd go, I don't like the sound of that, that sounds a bit risky. You know, it just doesn't cross his mind. He's genuinely just one of those people who doesn't have the sort of the fear that certainly I have, where you sort of question things.
Yeah.
He's just like, yeah, okay, let's crack on, and he ploughs into stuff.
Brilliant.
Incredible.
Brilliant. And we can't leave you without asking you, I mean, it's in the book, about obviously the end and the whole Clarkson incident where the BBC producer was punched by Clarkson. The apology that he made to you guys, I don't think you were that impressed with.
No, I just felt at the time that it was a bit half-hearted. I mean, in retrospect, I think that Jeremy had so much on his mind, not least that he could see his beloved show flashing before his eyes.
Yeah.
And it can't be understated how much Top Gear was Jeremy's programme and how much he put into it. You know, he was the absolute engine room of the show. And even after all those years, the delight and the enthusiasm that he brought to it, that powered it along, I just don't think we'd have lasted without him for a number of reasons. But that sheer energy in the office was one of them. And so when he could see it all slipping away, I think he had so much on his mind. And he's written in his newspaper columns about the other things that were happening in his life that were, you know, causing him to be in quite a sort of fragile place.
Yeah.
So it sort of explains some of what went on, but it also now, with the benefit of hindsight, explains why he sort of didn't put a lot of oomph into his apology. He almost sort of wanted to get it over and done with, and then he just left the office. And at the time, I was very angry about that. I felt that, you know, he should have given us the service of at least sort of sitting down and really, really saying sorry. So I can see why now, but I've written in the book about what happened at the time and all the various sort of things around it and why it was all such a sad time.
And as we move on now, of course, you know that the three guys have gone off to do a completely different show, and we've got Chris Evans taking the helm. Will you be involved in either of those?
I don't know at the moment. I've been asked. I know people on both shows, and they've both been very generous in sort of saying that the door is open if I want to go and have a chat about getting involved. So, I need to decide, I suppose, at some point. I think it's very exciting either way that we're going to get two car shows for the price of one.
Yeah.
This is sort of, this splits like chopping a worm in half. The worm doesn't die, you get two worms. If you like worms. A terrible analogy there, I apologize.
No, it's wonderful, it's wonderful. I mean, Chris, I've worked with Chris Evans, and he's an incredibly talented man, no doubt about that, but that is a seriously tough act to follow, isn't it?
It is, but if anyone's going to pull it off, I think it's him, because he, as you say, very talented bloke. I mean, incredible broadcasting brain.
Yeah, totally.
He's not going to let this get away. He will put his all into it, I'm convinced of it. Likewise, I think that Jeremy James and Richard, they won't occur to them just to sort of pocket a paycheck and phone it in. They're just not those sort of blokes. Jeremy particularly, they will be putting their all into this, because they'll want it to work. They'll use it as an opportunity to rethink some bits, but also to, I think, you know, keep what's good at the core of what they were doing before. So yeah, it is. I mean, you've got two very, very bright, very talented teams of people now working flat out to make two, I think, potentially really exciting and cool car shows. So next year's going to be good.
Yeah, well, it's been a delight to talk to you, Richard, and congratulations on being involved on one of the most successful television shows ever made. You know, 175 of them, and you were there for every one of them. That's did you get a gold watch at the end or not? No, I guess not.
No, I got a cardboard box full of all the stuff off my desk.
Love it. Well, the book is called And On That Bombshell. It's a brilliant read. Richard Porter, thank you so much for taking the time to come on and tell us about it today.
Thank you.
All the best.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.